impaired. Hello, this is Tyra Banks for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Flavor. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from chowhow.com, southernliving.com, foodandwine.com, and the News and Observer. Strange foods eaten during the Great Depression. 13 fascinating foods eaten during the Great Depression. When the stock market crashed in 1929, ushering in the Great Depression, the way Americans approached food and cooking drastically changed. For many people, sustained economic struggle led to forced creativity in the kitchen. Certain food items and ingredients were either no longer available or too expensive, such as fresh fruit and vegetables. Meals had to stretch for days, but still be nutritious. This led to lots of innovative recipes that are both fascinating and familiar to us. Some foods that were popular during the Great Depression might sound unpalatable, but they were products of ingenuity during a nearly impossible time. And guess what? We still enjoy some of these meals today. Maybe you remember your grandmother's special stew or your grandfather's myriad potato-based recipes. Maybe after a late night, you've made a pasta recipe with whatever you could find in the cabinet. So next time you find yourself paying for a farmer's salad with dandelion greens, think of how during the Great Depression, dandelion greens were a cheap or free way to get some much-needed vitamins and minerals, not just a trendy dish. So number one is prune pudding. Prunes remain strangely divisive among foodies, perhaps because we associate them with certain bathroom activities, perhaps because they seem rather boring. However, prune lovers extol the rich sweetness of the dried fruit, which remain very popular in Middle Eastern and Japanese cuisine. During the Great Depression, prunes were especially kind of a big deal. At the time, they were cheap, available, and easily preserved. Prunes are loaded with fiber and good for your digestion. They're kind of a superfood. What can you do with all this prune bounty? Make prune pudding, of course. Basically, the ingredients are prunes, sugar, and cinnamon, but you can be flexible with the spices. Add a cinnamon, but have cardamom? That works. The most famous example of prune pudding is then First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt's recipe. She served prune pudding at the White House to foreign dignitaries in an act of solidarity with struggling Americans. During the Roosevelt's tenure, the White House did not serve the most customarily fancy presidential foods, and Eleanor herself, with the assistance of dietitians, made up some recipes with mixed success. Number two, potato soup. Nowadays, potato soup can get quite fancy. Add creme fraiche, cauliflower, or fresh herbs, and blend in leeks to elevate the flavors. But don't forget that the humble potato remains the main ingredient, and that was crucial for those preparing food during the Great Depression. Potatoes were a staple of many meals at this time, but adding them to soup was one of the most popular methods of preparation. Potatoes are hearty and filling, but they're not precious. They're cheap to grow and don't require as much attention as other crops. You can pile a bunch of them in a basket and store them during the off-season. All you needed to do back then was make your potato soup, stretch, and then cook in some water, butter, and milk. Depending on what other ingredients you had around the house, maybe some onions, you could add that as well. Potato soup would make a comforting meal for a cold day. Number three, pasta and peas. Is pasta and peas Depression-era food or something you can order at your local Italian restaurant? Both. Lots of immigrant populations were trying to find their footing in the U.S. during the Great Depression, and they relied on their home traditions to keep the family fed. You might have heard of one famous name, Chef Boyardee, an immigrant from Piacenza, Italy, who eventually settled in Pennsylvania. Ettore Boiardi started the Chef Boyardee Food Company in 1929. The company's prepackaged spaghetti dishes helped lots of families through the Depression. If you didn't have access to Chef Boyardee's products, though, you could make your own pasta dishes. Pasta and peas was popular because pasta was cheap and you could get peas canned. In general, canned foods were emphasized during the Great Depression. They were perceived to be scientifically better and fresher. At least that was the story advertising companies were selling. cornbread and milk. Baking with very little became an art form during the Great Depression. Made with a total of three ingredients, cornmeal, salt, and water, cornbread was simple and fast to make. This is a dense bread because it lacks yeast, but it's hearty. When the bread started to get hard or go stale, families would put the chunks or crumbles in a glass of milk or buttermilk and eat it that way as a sweet treat. Consuming cornbread this way was very popular in the South, as well as in Appalachia. According to ICE chef Chris Scott, to this day, a family's often passed down cornbread recipe can tell a lot about their history. For example, if you're from the North, then your cornbread recipe probably has sugar or honey in it. If you're from the South, there's most likely no sweetener. If you're from the Appalachians, then you might tend to prepare your cornbread in a very old-fashioned manner with no leaveners, using simply ground corn, hot water, and lard, he wrote for the Institute of Culinary Education's blog, Diced. Next is hot dogs. If you have kids, you probably had to buy a lot of hot dogs at the grocery store on many occasions. They're a favorite among the little gourmets in your life. But hot dogs were also a dinner saver during the Great Depression. Folks would chop up hot dogs and add them to bean-based stews, or they would eat them in covered pickles, onions, and mustard. Hot dogs were cheap, filling, and available, the three main criteria for a solid Depression-era food item. As with many foods, there were regional variations. For example, Chicago's version is classically topped with mustard, relish, onions, tomatoes, pickles, peppers, and celery salt, and comes in a poppy seed bun. These hot dogs were once called Depression sandwiches, and a local chain called Flukey's claimed to have come up with them. Chicago-style hot dogs were really a product of the Great Depression, Professor Bill Savage told Block Club Chicago. A nickel could get you a hot dog with all these condiments on it that made it something approaching a full meal. In Brooklyn, you could get a hot dog at Nathan's Famous on the cheap. In 1939, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, yes, Eleanor again, even served Nathan's hot dogs to King George VI and Elizabeth of England. Chipped beef and cream. Chipped beef and cream seems to have originated as an army meal and existed at least as far back as 1910. And families looking to save money used the recipe during the Depression. Usually added to toast, creamed chipped beef was a popular meal because sliced, dry beef was available during the Great Depression, and it could keep for quite a long time on the shelf. People also called this meal S on a shingle, which is nice. The beef is kind of like a thin jerky. It's salted, dried, pressed, and then sliced. You can get necessary protein from it. And after pairing with cream or a butter, milk, and flour mixture, and slopping it on toast, you'd feel pretty full. The dish was pretty popular in eastern Pennsylvania and New Jersey. In fact, at some Cracker Barrel and IHOP restaurants, cream chipped beef was once an item on the menu. While the dish is no longer available at those establishments, you can find it at Golden Corral. Dandelion salad. Ah, dandelions, the pretty weeds. They grow everywhere and their leaves are edible, making simple dandelion salad a popular option for Depression-era families looking to get some vitamins and minerals. Clara Canucciari, a cook who before she passed away in 2013 became well-known for her YouTube videos demonstrating how she prepared meals during the Great Depression, praised the plant in one such video for being free and good for you. But if you decide to forage for your own dandelions, make sure they haven't been sprayed with pesticides. You can also get dandelion greens at many restaurants. They're slightly bitter, depending on how young the leaf is, and many cooks like to brighten up the flavor of the greens with lemon and vinegar. You can add cheese, too, like pecorino. Get creative and throw in some beets or fennel. Also, why not saute them? Or make them into a pesto with your favorite nut and olive oil. Seems like dandelion greens are ready for their second act. Number 8, peanut butter and pickle sandwich. During the Great Depression, peanut butter was very cheap. It emerged in the Midwest during the 1890s, arguably invented by John Harvey Kellogg, yes, of Kellogg's cereals, and marketed for the masses. It gained further popularity when, in 1921, a California man named Joseph Rosefield used a chemical process called partial hydrogenation to make peanut butter shelf-stable. Guess what else can stay on the shelf for a long time? Pickles. So why not combine the two? Put them together on homemade bread, and there you go, a peanut butter and pickle sandwich. Does it sound gross? Maybe. But in fact, lots of people still make them, and new fans are converted daily. Don't have pickles? You can use mayonnaise. Peanut butter and mayonnaise sandwiches were also pretty popular and promoted as healthy, protein-packed meals. Why don't you get a little wild and add all three ingredients together? Number 9, potato candy. Even during times of scarcity, it's important to treat yourself. Potato candy was a way people during the Great Depression could have something sweet. Potato candy is said to have originated in Germany, but Americans added the peanut butter. The recipe was simple to make. You could whip up a batch with one potato. Russet potatoes are the best since they are simple to mash and don't taste overly robust. A lot of powdered sugar, milk, vanilla, salt, and peanut butter. Those who have made batches report that the candy is creamy and soft and doesn't really taste like potatoes, probably due to all the sugar. If you're tired of hearing about peanut butter, though, don't fret. You have options. There are tons of other sweet, thick spreads that lend themselves to this recipe, but just weren't around when potato candy was first created. Nutella and almond butter sound pretty tasty. Tomato soup cake. A cake made from canned Campbell's tomato soup? This sweet treat is kind of a spice cake that was very popular during the Great Depression. Home bakers started adding tomato soup to cake batter in place of milk or buttermilk in the 1930s to make it moist. In fact, poet Sylvia Plath, who grew up during the later parts of the Great Depression, famously made tomato soup cake and other baked goods. When Plath moved to England, she sent a letter to her mother wondering about baking measurements. How many ounces are there in an American tomato soup can you use for tomato soup cake? I didn't think to question, but our can seemed to be bigger than yours, as my cake was a bit wet. The cake itself is quite festive tasting, especially with cream cheese frosting, which would not have been associated with it during the Great Depression. The addition of cinnamon, clove, nutmeg, and allspice gives the cake warmth, and the tomato soup is fascinatingly delicious and appropriate as part of that combination. Enjoy your Hoover stew while hanging out in your Hooverville, a Great Depression-era term for shanty towns, and wearing a Hoover blanket, which is a newspaper. A lot of unfortunate things became associated with President Herbert Hoover when the Depression hit, but Hoover stew wasn't bad. This is in part due to its flexibility as a recipe. This Depression food staple is basically a throw-it-all-in kind of soup, starring canned or boxed pantry goods. Traditional ingredients included macaroni, hot dogs, tomatoes, and corn. But during the Depression, none of that was guaranteed to be available, so you just had to make it work somehow. Lots of misses? Probably. Lots of hits? Probably. This meal was popular on soup kitchen lines and likely helped feed countless Americans who were struggling to make ends meet. And today, we've all had some kind of version of this meal when it's cold outside and we feel too lazy to make the trek to the grocery store. Peanut butter stuffed onions. Arguably way less popular than the peanut butter and pickle sandwich, this dish was another way to emphasize putting two available items together. Peanut butter stuffed onions were a Depression staple. Peanut butter stuffed onions were a Depression staple created by the Bureau of Home Economics and promoted in advertisements. The Bureau wasn't too concerned with taste at the time. It was trying to promote meal ideas that would help Americans feel full while getting necessary vitamins and minerals. This striking-sounding dish was served hot, with the peanut butter stuffed into the onion's center, and then the whole thing roasted for about an hour. Ernest Hemingway was a fan, kind of. He reportedly enjoyed peanut butter on white bread with slices of onion. In his novel Islands in the Stream, he refers to this culinary mix as the Mount Everest special. There are, of course, dishes that pair peanuts and onions very skillfully, especially in Thai cuisine. But there's a big difference between subtly combining flavors versus jamming a blob of peanut butter into a whole onion. Next is water pie. Looking for an easy dessert? Look no further than Depression-era water pie. Basically, take an unbaked pie shell and put the following ingredients into it. Water, flour, sugar, tiny bit of vanilla extract, and some pats of butter. Then shove it in the oven. During a time when fresh fruit pies were not a reality for many people, water pie was a reminder that even though times were difficult, there could still be sweetness. It was cheap, easy, and festive. People who have made this pie report that it tastes buttery, but is less creamy than a traditional custard pie. Cookbook author and YouTube creator Barry Lewis described it as looking like a wallpaper paste pie, but felt it tasted good enough. So next, Whole Foods says these will be the biggest food trends of 2026. Today's Whole Foods Markets Trends Council revealed the foods and trends they will expect will influence what grocery stores will be stocking and what people will be buying in 2026. For several years, the Austin, Texas-based grocery chain has led the way in shaping flavors and ingredients for dinner, health foods, snacks, and other categories. And based on what they're sharing and what we've already eaten of these trends, things will be extra delicious in 2026. Earlier this fall, I traveled to Austin to learn from members of the Whole Foods team about these predictions for 2026, how people are shopping today, and ways to incorporate these trends into what you're cooking in the future. Here's what'll be on your plate soon. Number one, better freezer options for meals. This is perhaps my favorite of the trends. You might hear me say this again, but no promises, because it speaks to a need of many of us have. Good, healthy dinner options that fit in the time we actually have. It's not new that companies are trying to stock out their offerings in the freezer section. Air fryer ready fish, chicken, and beef are plentiful, as are more frozen, microwave ready vegetables and grains. Whole Foods recognizes that need and says the offerings will only get better. Customers are looking to pair high quality ingredients with globally inspired flavors and time saving hacks. And these frozen options are perfect for meal planners that need a night off or for budget-conscious foodies who want a break from eating out, the company wrote in their trends report. Number two, brighter flavors thanks to vinegar. I take it back. This might be my favorite. A lot of folks have sipped on vinegars for health their benefits for years, decades even. Unfiltered versions can have healthy bacteria that are good for your gut, but some people just like vinegar-forward flavors in their salad dressings, drinks, condiments, and more. But don't think just plain distilled vinegar. So many more are available, and stores like Whole Foods are seeking to expand offerings to consumers. Now we're witnessing vinegar's modern renaissance with consumers seeking out premium small-batch options, bold new flavors, and innovative formats that elevate everything from home-cooked meals to craft cocktails and mocktails on restaurant menus, the trend statement says. Instant isn't a dirty word. Likes a growing assortment of freezer options, Whole Foods is eyeing better selections of instant foods, from microwave rice packs that accompany meals on the go, lunch options that you can keep in a desk drawer. A favorite I tried during my time in Austin is the line of Ahana's Power Bowls, which are made with grains, legumes, and veggies. And of course, lots of spice, so nothing about it is boring. You need only add hot water or cold and microwave it. It beats most sad desk lunches any day. Next, better for you sweets. When you want to eat a little something sweet, brands are providing you with more ways to do it that are a bit more mindful. Everything from chocolate bars to candy made with less sugar, alternative sugars, or sweetened naturally with honey or maple syrup, for example, are filling up store shelves. We're seeing jam, chocolate, and gummy brands leaning in on real fruit in their products rather than high amounts of sugar for flavor and texture, the brand said in their trend report. Good food, great design. It's true that we eat with our eyes first, so we're drawn to beautiful colors and textures in foods. But we're also captivated by great product design, and brands know that. Whole Foods is calling this trend kitchen couture, and it's all about creating vibrant, emotionally uplifting home spaces, even on kitchen counters. They add, today's consumers are drawn to eye-catching artwork that was previously reserved for wine labels, but now brings an aesthetic appeal to everyday items and staples. Brands have embraced this movement with bright, bold colors and designs that can enhance any countertop or kitchen shelf. An extension of Little Luxuries, this trend is an easy way to treat yourself to something both beautiful and delicious. Female farmers growing food. Last year, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations declared 2026 the International Year of the Woman Farmer. Their mission is to draw attention to the challenges women farmers face across the globe, while also highlighting the vitally important roles these women play in providing for their families, their communities, and all of us. Whole Foods is doing their part by highlighting the farmers making the products on their shelves and the programs that are helping to keep farms and families and women creating the changes we need for the future of our food and planet. With multi-generational farms dwindling and fewer young people choosing careers in farming, it's more important than ever to celebrate change makers in the industry, Whole Foods said in the statement. Next, flip to fiber. You're not going to miss that everyone, and I do mean everyone, is focused on protein right now. It is in everything from our coffees to our yogurts. But now fiber has something it would like to say. From pantry staples like oats and, of course, good old-fashioned vegetables, to prebiotic sodas and fiber-rich supplement powders, pastas, and breads, the grocery store shelves will soon look a little more fiber-friendly. My new favorite in this category is the 365 by Whole Foods Market Organic Caramelized Pineapple Prebiotic Soda. This beverage tastes like a relaxing day on a beautiful beach. The fiber in this drink is courtesy of inulin, a type of soluble fiber like you'll find in onions, asparagus, and bananas. The drink is also less than $2 a can, which can't be said for some other similar gut-friendly sodas. Number 8, new fats on the block. Like ghee before it, beef tallow is having a moment in the fat spotlight. Of course, Southerners have known for generations the benefits of cooking with rendered fat, but in 2026 is tallow's time to shine. Once a staple in traditional cooking and prized for its high smoke point and rich flavor, tallow is being rediscovered by consumers who value ancestral ingredients and are looking for oil alternatives, the press release says. This old-school fat is having a moment on social media, though it's actually been used for centuries for frying and baking. All right, and why you should never serve beer in a chilled glass. So serving beer in a frosted glass is a familiar gesture in many bars and restaurants, often regarded by thirsty patrons as a mark of thoughtful service and hospitality. The image of a glass shimmering with ice, promising instant refreshment and unparalleled enjoyment, became ingrained in American beer culture as a symbol of status, refinement, and best practice. But for those who cherish quality over outdated optics, the practice is not only unnecessary, it can actually diminish the experience of drinking a well-made beer. Don't believe it? Trust the science or try a side-by-side taste test and thank us later. How do we get here, and why are frosted glasses a thing? In the mid-20th century, mass-market beers dominated the scene. Light lagers were largely designed for maximum refreshment rather than depth of flavor or complexity of aroma. These were beers that were easy to enjoy, meant to be consumed cold and quickly without much contemplation. As establishments sought to reinforce the allure of an icy cold pour, the frosted glass became standard, its frosty appearance a visual promise of coolness and refreshment. And during warm summer months or in smoky taverns, the chilled glass added appeal, making macro lagers even more palatable by masking imperfections and sharpening their crisp, quaffable qualities. But the frosted glass doesn't serve all brews equally. How frosted glasses ruin good beer. While frosted glasses may suit lighter macro brews such as Budweiser, Miller Coors, or Pabst Blue Ribbon, helping them stay cold and go down easily, for beers with more complexity than just being fizzy and yellow, the frosty effects can be surprisingly detrimental. The rise of American craft brewing scene, with its more varied and nuanced beer styles, exposed the shortcomings of frosted glass service. Beer is an intricate combination of flavors, aromas, and textures, each carefully considered to provide a unique and layered experience. A frosted glass, unfortunately, interferes with much of that craft. The ideal serving temperature for beer ranges from 35 degrees Fahrenheit to 60 degrees Fahrenheit, depending on the style. Excessive cold suppresses the volatile compounds that give beer its aroma. These scents can include anything from floral notes of hops to fruity esters or spicy undertones imparted by yeast. Instead of greeting the senses with a vibrant bouquet, beer served in a frosted glass seems muted and subdued. Ultimately, if beer is being served from a properly refrigerated keg or bottle, why would you need to chill your glass at all? Temperature also plays a crucial role in the perception of flavor. When beer is served too cold, its complexity flattens, leaving only a generic taste of chill. These hints of caramel in your brown ale, sweet baking spice in your seasonal brew, or citrus snap in your favorite IPA, all lost to frost. Mouthfeel suffers too. Ice crystals on a frozen glass act as nucleation points, causing carbonation to rapidly escape and create an overly foamy head in the glass instead. Not only does that result in a frothy mess that is tough to drink through, but also leaves the beer flat by the time you're halfway through. There's also the matter of hygiene. Glasses kept in freezers can absorb odors or accumulate residues, becoming dirty with mystery molecules floating around the shared freezer space, or even detergents or cleansers if chilled directly from the washer while damp. All these possibilities can introduce off flavors that further compromise the beer's intended profile. Ultimately, if the beer is being served from a properly refrigerated keg or bottle, why would you need to chill your glass at all? You wouldn't do it for wine, so why single beer out? That's right, you shouldn't. When, if ever, should you use a frosted glass? There are rare occasions when a frosted glass may be acceptable, but these are typically for ultralight, mass-market lagers, or low-alcohol beers designed to refresh and without much thought or nuance. For these selections, the loss in flavor or aroma is negligible, and the chilled glass may indeed add a pleasurable coolness to something already designed to be innocuous. But for any beer with craftsmanship, character, or aromatic depth, a clean, room-temperature glass is best. Most craft beers reach their greatest expression at 40 degrees Fahrenheit to 55 degrees Fahrenheit, where both aroma and flavor flourish. Take the time to enjoy a great beer's subtleties. It's a small act of respect for the brewer, the beer, and your own experience. And if you'd like it colder, just chill the beer longer. Skip the frozen glass. One of Durham's most popular pizzerias is coming to Raleigh. Here's where. A downtown staple in Durham is bringing a taste of its wood-fired pizza to Raleigh. After more than a decade in the business, Pizzeria Toro is opening a second location at Seaboard Station. It'll be a neighbor to the Common Market, a popular Charlotte-based deli and market set to open next year. Everything just came together in the right way, chef and partner Gray Brooks said in a release sent to the Newsroom Observer. We've always been really picky about where to put another Toro, which I guess is pretty obvious after 13 years. But when this opportunity came up, it felt just right. We love the neighborhood and the space. It's the garage from a former trucking company. The menu will have a lot of the same items, but won't necessarily reflect the Durham menu, Brooks told the NNO, explaining that it'll be shaped by what their team gets from local farmers in the Triangle. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Flavor. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Tyra Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or reading impaired, print impaired. Flavor is available as a podcast at our website, NorthCarolinaReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, 919.